You know, not every place in the world has access to, you know, a well-functioning banking system. And, yeah. you know, not everyone in the world has a credit card. And if you look at some of these emerging economies, it was very clear early on that this could be, like, you know, game-changing.
Welcome to Boston Blockchain, where we focus on the people and projects that are driving innovation in the industry. I'm Kyle Hedman of China Shop Productions, and today's guest is Katie Chase, Chief Operating Officer at Coinmetrics. In this episode, we discuss the evolution of Fidelity's blockchain initiatives, the impact of cryptocurrency in crisis situations, and her transition to Coinmetrics, where she focuses on data innovation in the crypto ecosystem. She also touches on the challenges of data aggregation, stablecoins, and the importance of risk management in the crypto market. Check out our links in the show notes if you want to learn more. Now let's meet our guest.
So tell me a little bit about yourself, Katie. How did you get involved in the blockchain space?
I have been involved in the blockchain space for quite a while. I was introduced to Bitcoin when I was at Fidelity Investments. Mm-hmm. So I want to say, and I haven't had to go through the origin story in quite some time, but I want to say 2012, 2013, kind of right in that time frame, Fidelity was really interested in understanding this disruptive technology from the perspective of how is this going to impact our customers, how is this right. going to impact the firm, and how can we make sure that we're positioning ourselves to be part of this technical revolution.
Right, right.
And I was very involved in that kind of early effort. So we did a lot of scenario planning around crypto assets. At the time, Bitcoin was mm-hmm. crypto assets. We started a lot of experimentation through our Fidelity Center for Applied Technology and our incubator program. And over time, sort of, I moved from a more strategic role in that and kind of guiding the conversation and the idea generation to working with the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, which is the R&D arm of Fidelity, where I was responsible for the blockchain incubator.
Okay. Yeah. What were some of the cool things that came out of that then? Can you talk about any of it or no?
Like a lot of the stuff you see at Fidelity today had its origins in their blockchain incubator. So, you know, everything from the custody solution that is kind of widely available in the market. A lot of the early experimentation on the wallet development happened in the blockchain incubator to sort of the investment products. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were doing everything from thematic research that is sort of the tip of the spear right. for any emerging technology. What is like the broadest aperture you can take to understand all the technologies out there and how it could influence the world in which we live in, to sort of winnowing that down to what could be some cool things we could do from an experimental perspective to taking those experiments and then kind of bringing them into sort of production products at the organization. So I would say I don't actually remember when Fidelity Center or Fidelity Digital Asset Services actually launched, mm-hmm. but prior to their launch, all of that work was handled in the incubator.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really, really cool time to be at Fidelity. Their senior leadership team was very involved and supportive of the exploration. We had, I want to say 30 people just working on experimentation. So
right.
It was a great, great.
I've always been fascinated by how the institutions have viewed the Bitcoin industry or the crypto industry, blockchain technology and all that.
And they were definitely very early, right? They were very early.
But
Fidelity
not.
Was not. Fidelity yeah. was very early. A lot of it was not very public when we were working on an incubator because there's a lot of experiments that don't sort of make it right. to like the cutting room floor, or that's probably not the right metaphor, but you know
what I'm saying. Yeah.
it was a great time to be there. I think what drew me into it was the interesting technology, but also, you know, this idea of democratizing finance. And a lot of us that were on those early projects saw how this could really make finance more accessible to like a broader range of individuals. You know, not mm-hmm. every place in the world has access to, you know, a well-functioning banking system. And, yeah. you know, not everyone in the world has a credit card. And if you look at some of these emerging economies, it was very clear early on that this could be like, you know, game-changing and really sort of, you know, create commerce and financial inclusion and really open a lot of doors for a lot of people.
I think, was it the Ukraine war that when that started, I think we started to see a lot of like utility for Bitcoin, like people who lost a lot of access to their traditional finance means were able to still do transactions because of crypto.
Absolutely. We saw it firsthand at Coinmetrics, which is where I'm at now.
Mm-hmm.
We have employees or contractors that work out of the Ukraine. So we saw sort of, you know, week one or two that they started to lose access to their banking. And in that period of time, we were able to get them, you know, USDC, which is a crypto asset stablecoin payment for their work that they were doing with us.
Wow. That's so,
yeah. And that's there were incredible. All kinds of, you know, charity drives where folks were accepting donations for, you know, different causes around that period of time in cryptocurrency.
What are some other interesting ways you've seen crypto used that maybe people haven't really thought too much about?
I mean, you know, largely it has been a speculative asset, but I think where you're seeing real utility really is in that sort of stablecoin space. Like that's a real world use case that is, you know, now well beyond kind of the Ukraine war.
Right.
You know, very, very valuable for a lot of folks. You know, what used to be kind of that remittance space where, you know, you might go to Western Union and send payment to your family members, I think is now facilitated in a much more, you know, seamless way through crypto assets. I think the other thing that you're seeing is this is a way for individuals in less stable economies to hold an asset that could retain its value.
Right. Like what were some places like Turkey, I think.
Turkey's a big stable coin, you know,
Argentina.
Acquirer. I think Venezuela has some pretty challenging kind of inflationary dynamics in their economy. So, you know, even if you're not needing to transfer from one country to another, it is a way for folks in country to be able to hold something that's going to retain its value.
Yeah.
Like we thought, much, much better than a local currency.
We thought inflation was bad in the U.S. after COVID hit. Like imagine 130%.
I know. So yeah, that I think there's some real utility there. You know, you're starting to see it's cool, but I'm not sure like how, you know, much net better the world is because of it, but gaming, utility.
Yeah, the way they've incorporated NFTs into gaming to
and like I think
Zedrun is one of the really cool ones.
Like, yeah, you know. And I think you'll see even, you know, even more of it and people won't even realize that there's kind of a cryptocurrency rail at some point. But if you think about how these, you know, I have two teenage sons. If you think about how these kids are spending money on these platforms. I don't think it's still a thing, but there used to be this game Fortnite and they would buy skins and they'd buy dances and it's kind of contained there and you can't sort of transfer it to your friends or do sort of very much with it. I think you can see how there'd be much more utility in these game systems if it was kind of on a blockchain rail.
Or if you basically some more cross compatibility, I think.
Cross compatibility, right? You know, me transferring it to you, or, you know, we had a situation where my one son wanted to like quit Fortnite and get off of it altogether. I'm like, can you send all that stuff you bought to your brother? And you actually, you know, it's not easy to do that, actually. So
interesting.
You can buy people's stuff in there, but you can't like inherit somebody else's stuff.
Right. So you mentioned transitioning to Coinbase, or sorry, not Coinbase, Coinmetrics, where you're at now. How did that transition come about?
So I've been at Coinmetrics for almost 5 years now. I was actually introduced to Coinmetrics as a client. So I was a client of Coinmetrics when I was at Fidelity. I also happen to know the founder of Coinmetrics very well. So he worked with me at Fidelity, and one of their early investors, Castleline Ventures, where, you know, our founder eventually ended up. They also worked with me at Fidelity. So there's lots of kind of ways in which I knew Coinmetrics very, very well before I even started working there. And, you know, there was an opportunity to spend all my hours on blockchain and crypto assets. So when I was at Fidelity, I was leading the blockchain incubator. I also was head of strategy for the entire Center for Applied Technology.
Oh, wow.
So I was, you know, spending a good amount of my time thinking about emerging technologies like AI or quantum computing and sort of other really cool things. But my passion was in blockchain, and this allowed me to do that all the time.
Right. Did that passion start before Fidelity, or was it the first introduction?
That Fidelity was my first introduction. Yeah, wow. And it was an assignment. You know, it was like somebody assigned it to me, and I was like, "Oh, this is kind of cool." But you know, once you start learning about it, it's really hard not to sort of fall in love with it.
Yeah, isn't it funny though how sometimes like the passions can like come out of like the least expected places? Like you find the thing that you're meant to do.
Yeah.
Like, in such the.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel like life kind of takes you on this meandering path to where you're supposed to get to.
I think is the word, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned something about a lot of the products and the ideas that you had when you worked at Fidelity that never really made it past the stage of idea. How many of those do you think maybe were just too early
Oh, a lot of them. What we would do with those is we would, you know, kind of put them back on the shelf, so to speak, and identify what was the reason that experiment failed. Was it because, you know, the technology wasn't ready? Was it because the regulatory environment wasn't ready? Was it because, you know, potentially there was another like component of the sort of broader workflow that needed to be developed first? And we called those tripwires.
Yeah.
Okay. And we kind of mark those and then monitor those, right? A lot of the use cases weren't viable because you really needed to settle in US dollars. Mm-hmm. So any kind of securities transaction, you really aren't going to settle that in Bitcoin.
Okay.
And so the tripwire is, okay, when is there a sort of US dollar equivalent on chain? Well, now there is. I have no idea how they're, you know, keeping track of that these days, but it's probably why you are starting to see a lot of things tokenized. So you're starting to see money market funds get tokenized,
right?
Because they're able to put those on chain, and then, you know, they can conduct activity with other parties on chain in a US dollar equivalent that kind of everybody understands,
right.
And knows how to value a US dollar.
So do they ever go back to those projects then and try to...
I'm sure they do. Yeah. And I mean, it's how the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology operated more generally. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were lots of things that they started early on. I forget what it was called. I think it was like the Pebble Watch. There was some experimentation about developing applications for that. It was not successful, but then they had those things on the shelf when the Apple Watch came out, and they were able to just kind of move that much more quickly into reality.
Man, I kind of want to apply for your position.
It's a really, really cool organization. So I certainly didn't leave Fidelity because I wanted to leave Fidelity.
Right.
It was because I was going to, you know, spend all my time in crypto assets.
So tell me what you get to do now that you couldn't do before. Like what's the most exciting part of what you're doing now with Coinmetrics?
We are constantly innovating and coming up with new products. So, you know, the company itself produces crypto asset data. So any crypto asset data you can think of, we probably have it. That includes all the data from the trading venues like Coinbase or Kraken, as well as all the on-chain data, all the data that you can, you know, derive from these public permissionless blockchains
like
directly.
The wallet holders.
Yeah, like the addresses, the or the holders, the transaction activity or velocity, all the network activity, sort of how, you know, how fast are blocks being produced, or what are the fees going to maybe miners, or what is the yield on the staking and maybe a proof of stake type of ecosystem. And so this is like a very vast space. And one of the really great things about working at a very small company is you're very nimble and you can kind of move into new areas as they emerge, actually really, really quickly.
Right.
And that's been really fun. So when I first joined, I think we had, say, two product lines. I think we have 10 product lines now.
Yeah. You have TradingView compatibility,
yeah,
which is really neat.
TradingView compatibility. Yeah. It's something crazy. I think they do like 64 releases a week or something on average. So,
So
it's very agile, very fast paced. Mm-hmm. Whereas at a big company, you know, you have to be very careful. You've got a very big installed client base and you want to make sure you're not disrupting what's already working when you're releasing these new things. I guess there's just a little bit less risk when you work at a startup, and so you the pace can be much, much faster. I also always get to work with really great people that know a lot of, they know a lot about crypto assets, and that's what they want to talk to you about. And I know that doesn't sound very fun to most people.
Who like talking about it like talking about
it. Yeah. And so, you know, we all have a lot in common that way. So that's really nice also.
Right. One of the things I noticed on there too is you do weekly market reports, which look pretty in depth. I mean,
yeah,
the one I looked at was from 2 weeks ago.
You're looking at our website?
Of course. I try to do a little bit of research. This is a 19-page report, and you're doing this every week?
Yeah, so State of the Network comes out every Thursday, and it covers tends to be on-chain topic, but, you know, a different topic that we think is timely to the space. We actually have another report that comes out on Thursdays that is State of the Market, which is more of like the market overview snapshot. It kind of looks like the finance page in like the Wall Street Journal. So we produce those two reports every week. We also do special insights, which are more in-depth, much more detailed, long-form reports. I'd say we probably do about one of those a month. We're coming out with new products. Also, we're coming out with our single asset research series this month. So we'll have our first coverage initiation piece for Bitcoin. That's going to be a little bit of a different format. It looks a little bit more like a sell-side research report. We're working on some sector research formatting. We're going to come out with our stablecoin piece, which is one of our sectors, probably next month. And then we've got our movers and shakers, which, you know, talks about new assets that we're covering from a crypto asset taxonomy perspective. You know, how do we classify this into a sector? We pick up new asset coverage when an asset becomes like widely accessible. Okay. And for us, that means that it's traded on more than 25% of our trust exchanges, which probably means as a user, you'd be able to get it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If it's not meeting that threshold, it's probably not very accessible to most people.
Yeah, I think I have some like Skydle tokens from an airdrop that I have not been able to figure out how to get rid of.
We probably don't classify that.
Yeah, I don't think you do.
We don't cover that one.
One of the challenges, though, it looks like, because you're basically like a data aggregator. You're trying to collect as much data and then have like a centralized place to be able to analyze and use that. Are you like a market feed almost too? Like, can people use your data as
a... Yep, we have a market data feed and we have a on-chain data feed. These are two different products of ours. One's Market Data Feed, one's Network Data Pro. We have an index product that provides index levels, single asset index levels, multi-asset index levels, kind of like a multi-asset index could be like the crypto asset equivalent to like the S&P 500.
Okay. Oh, nice. Yeah.
We have products that just describe these assets. So we have asset profiles, which are just like descriptive information about, you know, 220 some assets. So, you know, what is the consensus mechanism? When was the first block? You know, what was the genesis of this blockchain? Like, what date was it launched? We have sector taxonomy that we produce with Goldman Sachs and MSCI called Datonomy that tells you what sector these assets are in. We have a security master. We have lots of products. And we have, like I said, maybe 10 products right now.
So one of the challenges I think that I would see you guys having is there's so many different exchanges out there. Mm-hmm. Like, how are you collecting the data when it seems like it's probably scattered in like thousands of different places?
It is. So we do limit our exchange coverage universe also. So I think we have data on a few more than 40 exchanges. Even that is a lot to keep up with. There's a lot of data coming off these exchanges. But we do a very good job sort of monitoring the status channels and the forums where the exchanges are announcing sort of changes to their APIs. Yeah. So we're able to kind of get ahead of that and make sure that we're well prepared for kind of any kind of exchange. We also have a relationship with some of these exchanges where we have someone to call if we have questions about a new field that they're providing, or if we're seeing latency issues or excessive downtime on the exchange.
Yeah, so latency issues are going to be huge, for especially if people are using this for trading,
right? Yeah. And I think then the challenge is just they all kind of produce the data a little bit differently. So normalizing it, understanding how they're producing it, and then making it so that our users don't have to understand how they're producing it. But I would say the exchange world is way easier to get your arms around than the on-chain data world.
Oh, I would.
I mean, that stuff in its raw format, you know, one blockchain looks completely different from the next. At least with the exchanges, you're like, oh, that's a trade. That's like an order.
Right.
Like, these are things that I recognize. Sometimes it's hard to understand on some of these blockchains, like what is kind of the transaction that's transferring value versus a transaction that might be like a governance transaction or some kind of like voting activity. And some of them are account-based, some of them are UTXO-based. They all have their own little strange flavor.
Right.
So we do have to have protocol specialists or experts in these crypto asset ecosystems to help us interpret and understand the on-chain data.
Does AI help at all with that?
It hasn't yet. We are leveraging AI to some extent in our product to help our users understand our documentation, but our documentation is like fairly well formatted, so I think the AI can interpret it a little bit more easily.
Right.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure why the LLMs haven't sort of fully crawled to every blockchain. And
sounds like they're too different to apply one thing to multiple.
It is getting better. We tried some of it. I mean, I guess it's probably not even a year now when we first saw like the explosion in this LLM stuff, but we would ask it simple questions like, you know, provide me with, you know, how many active addresses are, you know, on blah, blah, blah blockchain. And it was like giving you the wrong answer. And that's like a that's like a factual thing.
Yes,
so
yes. One of the things that helps with LLMs that I've recently learned is priming statements. So before you ask your question, you prime it by saying something like, you're a head researcher at this institution and you're doing, your project is this thing. This is the scope of your work. Now you ask the question. So you kind of give it a context to step into.
Yeah.
And sometimes that helps give you more fine-tuned answers out of it.
That's good to know. I mean, I use it a ton personally for, you know, cleaning up my emails or research. You know, the CEO and I have a joke. We call ChatGPT Steve.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, you know, our team might actually think that like we're going to go have Steve help us with something and that he's like a person, right. But no, it's ChatGPT. So
ChatGPT thinks our CEO is another one of our frequent podcasters because she punched his name into it one time and now it signs every letter we do with sign Clary. You mentioned stable coins a minute ago, and I remember there being an incident with one of them collapsing not too long ago.
I think it was it 2022?
It was a couple of years ago, yeah. Was it the U.S. dollar coin?
I'm trying to put it behind me. I think Terra Luna situation that you're thinking of?
Yes, yes. So what exactly happened with that one? Because aren't stable coins supposed to be like tied to a physical asset?
I mean, I think that was like some kind of weird logarithmic kind of setup.
Right, where they weren't actually tied to the dollar. They were...
I mean, it was bonkers. I think a lot of people had... there were kind of folks out there ahead of that being like, oh, this is kind of scary. It's sort of weird how this one works. But... yeah, that whole period was just like an unmitigated disaster for for the cryptocurrency space.
Were there signs that you guys were seeing that something was funny going on there?
You know, I don't think we were paying that much attention to that asset. I don't even know if we had it under coverage, to be completely honest with you. But, you know, we were kind of tracking the fallout from that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you saw a lot of... The market basically like crumbled around it.
Right.
So there were a lot of sellers liquidating positions. Then I think shortly thereafter, maybe even the same year, I think FTX kind of imploded. So yeah, I think that whole year was just sort of a blight on the crypto asset space. I think, you know, we saw as an industry that we probably hadn't paid enough attention to risk and risk management and sort of monitoring.
Right.
And really doing our due diligence around what we were buying and backing. And so if anything positive came out of that, I think that it is that more people are paying attention to risk and they are more fully vetting, you know, crypto asset founders and projects and trying to make sure that like the story really does like tie out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, making sure that you're not just following a charismatic leader who can say the right things at the right time, but
right.
He's actually doing the right things.
Right, right. And, you know, it's interesting to kind of have startup founders getting into the financial services space.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of there's an interesting personality kind of clash there in a way.
Okay.
I wouldn't say like entrepreneurs are necessarily the best risk managers.
But, yes, they're risking everything.
But, you know, financial services is about, you know, safekeeping people's assets and managing risk and complying with kind of rules and regulations that have been, quite frankly, put in place to protect customers so that something like an FTX doesn't happen.
Right.
So, yeah, it's sort of, I think, apparent now that, you know, even if you're a startup, like, you really do need to, like, try and understand just kind of the basic rules of financial services. And and even if there isn't kind of clear regulation and you're not putting sort of the controls in place from kind of a regulatory compliance perspective, you're doing it because you know it's in the best interest of your end customers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's great because you need data for a lot of that. So that's great for us.
You're right. So what's the website where people can go to learn more about CoinMetrics?
CoinMetrics.io. We didn't get the .com, but...
No. Well, the .io's are getting more popular nowadays,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, it's cool. It's like tech, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, coinmetrics.io, obviously, state of the network. We have that out on Substack. That's our Tuesday newsletter, and we're here locally in Boston.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Katie. I'm looking forward to watching your presentation.
Thanks.
The cover art for this podcast was custom designed for us by the amazing people at Epic Made. Epic Made is a digital art and animation studio that actually understands the magic behind powerful creative assets for gaming, entertainment, and tech. So visit epicmade.com to get expert creative help for campaigns, commercials, socials, and more. That's epic-made.com. DSpark is the leading user research platform for Web3. Companies can easily get feedback from any type of user, helping them build better products and improve their marketing. If you're interested in giving feedback, get paid USDC to share your opinions and improve Web3. Visit DSpark.io today. That's DSPARK.io. Bola allows you to create, tokenize, and finance invoices and manage all of your on-chain accounts. With TCS Blockchain, they recently went live with their groundbreaking solution that uses blockchain to settle freight invoices 90% cheaper and faster than traditional means. Thank you for helping make this show possible, Bola. Go to bolanetwork.com and tcsblockchain.com to learn more and join the waitlist. Numbers Protocol harnesses blockchain technology to enhance authenticity and traceability of digital content globally, with operational bases in London, LA, Dubai, and Taiwan. Recognized as the best in Web3 at the 2023 SXSW Awards and supported by Google and NVIDIA, Numbers Protocol offers the Capture, an all-in-one suite for content verification, copyright protection, and monetization. This technology has proven pivotal in projects like the archival of the 2020 U.S. presidential election and supports artists and businesses in ensuring the integrity and security of digital media. Jotto is a cutting-edge platform that amplifies the customer voice by making it simple for organizations to gather feedback through video, audio, and text. Using powerful AI, Jotto analyzes this feedback in real time to deliver actionable insights that help organizations understand their audience better. Whether it's governments, businesses, or events, Jotto enables a deeper connection by ensuring every voice is heard and valued. It's an essential tool for anyone looking to turn raw feedback into strategic actions and drive meaningful engagement. So once again, thank you to our sponsors for helping make the show possible, and thank you everybody for listening. The views and opinions expressed on this program are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial, legal, or professional advice. Always conduct your own research and consult with a qualified professional before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast. We appreciate your understanding and hope you enjoy the insights and expertise shared in today's episode.